Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Variety, celebrating more than 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
You know, this feeling that you have to be perfect all the time and you have to look a certain way and you have to be the best mom and you have to be the coolest mom and the best wife and have the perfect party house and everything is fabulous all the time. I kind of feel like the women in my family have sort of had a version of that, you know, where you just, you know, you put a smile on everything.
In playing accused murderer Candy Montgomery, Jessica Biel had to approach the role as someone more than just a villain, and indeed there was something completely relatable about the character. I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast, we talk to Candy star and executive producer Jessica Biel about adapting the real-life crime story. After that, we chat with Winning Time, the Rise of the Lakers dynasty star Adrian Brody about playing iconic Los Angeles Lakers coach Pat Riley. It's all next on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close. In 1980, Texas homemaker Candy Montgomery was accused of murdering Betty Gore, the wife of the man she was involved with. It was a crime no one saw coming, and that was part of the reason Jessica Biel was drawn to play the role in Hulu's limited series Candy. Starring opposite Melanie Lynskey and Pablo Schreiber, Biel completely transformed, wig, glasses, and all, into the character. She also worked double duty as an executive producer on the gory project.
Are you okay?
I'm fine.
Candy, where have you been?
Betty and I got to talking.
Hey, Candy, have you seen Betty at all today?
Candy, you can't be perfect all the time.
Variety's Emily Longaretta sat down with Jessica Biel to talk about starring and executive producing Candy and what brought her to the story.
The initial interest, and I guess what the reason my interest was piqued initially was the elegant writing. There were a few episodes that we were able to read that they had already, Robin and Nick, our writers and showrunners, had already written those first two episodes. So we were lucky enough to be able to read something kind of, you know, in a more developed form. The nonlinear storytelling, just the subtlety, the feeling of oppression, that like suburban oppression, the mundanity of these people's lives, it just kind of like flew off the page and was, you know, at times, you know, just stiflingly terrifying and also just normal and cool and nice and great and funny. And then, you know, it's quite oddly funny until it's not, you know? So I loved the writing to begin with. And then I started to, you know, learn about the story. I had never heard of the story before, which did surprise me because I'm a huge true crime fan and I listen to a lot of podcasts and I feel like I'm kind of up to speed on a lot of these, you know, intriguing true crime stories, especially from the past, but I didn't know this one. So once I really started to dive into, okay, who is this person? What is the story? How did this ending happen this way? And then I got really interested in why and how did this very normal woman, seemingly very normal, suburban, upstanding pillar of the community, good mother, good wife, nice human, how did she do this? How did she commit this crazy act of violence? So that sort of capped it. Like I thought, okay, I'm into this. I'm curious about this. I like these characters who are normal people and then have these weird triggering moments and do things that are out of their own character.
Yeah. I mean, and I always find it fascinating when a show is, you know, focused on technically the villain, which obviously she is, but she's not, you know, she's not like wearing a black hat and wearing, you know, it's a different kind of angle on that. So I'm curious how you kind of approached that as playing, you know, the antagonist, but also someone that people want to keep watching for multiple episodes, because that's not always an easy balance.
Yeah. The anti-hero or the anti-heroine, right, is what I guess is kind of colloquially we call that. Or the untrusting narrator. That's what it is. Something like that. That's the challenge, right? That's the challenge is okay. This person did some crazy stuff. And how do you make her lovable? How can we make the audience fall in love with her? And that was my whole goal, is I wanted to create this person that you really, really were conflicted. You know, you were with her, you're with her, you're with her, you're with her. And then wait a minute, I'm not sure if I'm with her. And then as the story unfolds, you kind of, you empathize with the actions, you get it on some level, you know, you connect on a human level in some way. And you're still kind of with her at the end. I mean, that's what I hoped to create. I'm not sure if it was 100% successful, but how do you do it, I guess, is the question. You just have to have so much empathy, and you have to really fall in love with your character. And you really have to not, I didn't play this character like she was the villain. I really just played her like a woman who had a lot of regrets and a lot of shame and had been taught to interact with the world in a certain way. And oops, guess what? She doesn't actually believe everything she says. Mm-hmm. And all of this stuff has been underneath the surface. And now it's just the volcano's exploded, you know? And I have empathy for that. So that was my angle in.
And that worked, because as an audience member, we have empathy, even though obviously she does something awful. I'm curious how, I mean, I feel like for an actor, especially like you said, you can't view her as a villain. And when you're playing her, you can't, you know, view her that way. How did you draw those parallels to her? How did you relate to her and tap into her?
I mean, I think there are so many things that she's experiencing that every human has experienced, specifically women have experienced, you know, this feeling that you have to be perfect all the time and you have to look a certain way and you have to be the best mom and you have to be the coolest mom and the best wife and have the perfect party house and everything is fabulous all the time. I kind of feel like the women in my family have sort of had a version of that, you know, where you just, you know, you put a smile on everything. And I do that in my life. And I'm working really hard to not do that. I'm working really hard to be really authentic, and it's getting easier. It's been a long journey. I've been working on this for many years. So I really connected to that feeling of, yeah, I'm really mad and I don't know how to communicate that because I have been hiding it for so long, or I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm, you know, and I don't know how, I don't have the tools to communicate what I need. And I think Candy really didn't have the tools. And she was brought up in a way that didn't give her any of the right equipment to be able to have a mature relationship with a partner or with a friend or with anyone and really be able to be authentic to what she was feeling. And I just understand that feeling. I feel like I've done that a lot in my life. And I think, you know, other things like this idea of, well, just this, you know, these regrets that people might feel about their lives and different decisions that they may have made that you think a lot about and wish you had made a different decision. Like, I get that. I feel that. I've experienced that in my life. And I feel like she experiences that. I guess probably those areas were my tap in to my parallel, to the parallels of my life and her life. Mm-hmm. And where I could really understand having a trigger moment where I just, you know, all the years that I've, you know, said, it's okay. I feel good. Everything's fine. You know, then it just comes flying out. That was my way into how I could really connect with her and her life.
And it seems that's, I mean, in today's world, that's something that I think people experience more and more, because especially with social media, we show the best part and that's that everyone's great and everything's perfect. And that's not, you know, reality. So sometimes we lose it for a few minutes. And so yeah, 100%. Obviously, I want to ask about the surprise guests we see in this, because something that obviously people are very excited about. And I love that it's Jason and Justin. I think it's so cool that it's both of them. Tell me a little how that came about and how, I mean, it's so cool that the characters and how it kind of is this meta situation. So tell me a little how that came about.
I am too, by the way, really excited about the combination of the two of them. Really what happened was, I mean, Justin and I, we share projects a lot in terms of, hey, read this. I really like it. Do you have any notes? What are you thinking? What do you think about it? Should I do it? Or I'm doing this, but I'm curious, you know, another perspective. We're just throwing scripts around at each other all the time for those kinds of, you know, development reasons. And he was reading Candy and he loved the episodes too. And he said, well, who's playing this guy? Who's playing Steve Deffenbaugh? And I said, oh, I don't know. Somebody probably an Atlanta local. We don't really have any money left. We sort of spent it all on our main cast. And this is one of our last, you know, cast members that we need to cast. So I don't know. But it's just going to be somebody local, like a great local up and coming person or something. And he said, I want to do it. And I really thought, okay, that's funny. I'd love for you to do this, but I know that's not really for real. And he's like, no, for real. I see the way in. I see how funny he could be, but also, you know, he's the one who really sees through her story. He's this major adversary for her. I mean, from the very beginning, he doesn't believe it for one second, you know? And I said, are you serious? And he said, I'm serious. And so I jumped on my phone, called my producing partner, Michelle. I said, okay, Justin wants to do this part. She goes, I already know. I've already been speaking to him. I was like, of course you guys already know. And then we just called Robin, our showrunner and our creator. And she, like us, was totally taken by surprise, thrilled by the idea. They sat down and had a meeting with Nick and with Mike Uppendahl, our number one and number five director. All he wanted was prosthetic belly and a wig. And he goes, you don't have to pay me anything. Just make sure I have my wig that I want. Make sure I have a prosthetic belly. And we were like, we can do that. So that's how that happened. And then, you know, maybe a couple of weeks later, we're still trying to cast this other character. Robin called Melanie and I and said, what do you guys think? What if Jason played the other deputy? And then when we do the reenactment in episode 5, he's playing Betty and Justin's playing you, playing your characters. Our heads exploded. You know, we were like, this is amazing. It was so funny. We just laughed so hard about the idea. And it just turned out so beautifully because those two, they should literally have their own like cop buddy comedy. They're so funny together. Really? Jason is we already know Justin is like a comedic genius, but Jason is unbelievable. I mean, it's not a surprise, but wow. It was amazing to watch them work together.
What was it like for you? I mean, sitting across from him, even at the table and, you know, being, and then him, he, like you said, he was the first one that kind of saw through her and kind of said like, well, did you do it? Because it's like, you immediately saw it. So it must've been interesting for you guys to take on these different characters in those scenes together.
Yeah. I mean, it was nerve-wracking at first. I felt a little like, oh gosh, am I going to be able to be free? And are my nerves going to get the best of me? Because now it's my partner sitting across from me. And, you know, I wasn't sure, but it was the total opposite. It was so comfortable and easy to improvise. And they were making, you know, this environment on set, which was kind of more fun than it normally was because they're really improvising together. And so it sort of gave me freedom to do that too. And I think he's a big supporter of mine in, you know, I just mean like in our relationship and in at work and privately, personally. So he was just holding a lot of good sacred space for me to feel comfortable. And I was doing the same for him. I hope he felt the same way, but it was a lot of fun being adversaries. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like did it make you guys want to work together again? Cause I think that could be so cool.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think we've always been kind of curious, like, well, when is that going to happen and what should it be? And it has to be the right thing. You know, I feel like, you know, if you're going to play romantic leads or something, that's a really particular thing. You got to do it really well. This is a really safe place to sort of explore what it's like to be on opposite sides. And then what's the next step from here? Like, what can we do after this? It definitely opened up my mind to thinking about other things we can work together on.
I wanted to ask you about kind of the roles that you've chosen more recently. And obviously since you and Michelle teamed up years ago, but have created obviously with The Sinner and with Cruel Summer, but the things that you're specifically acting in too, how is it for you what goes into choosing the right role for you now? Does it go into timing and location? Is it more subject matter based? Like, what is it for you that really draws you to something project now?
I mean, it's definitely subject matter based. It's definitely character driven. Is it something new that I've never done before? I'm always intrigued about that. Can I transform physically in some way? Am I terrified? You know, do I look at this and go, I have no idea how to do this, but I really want to do it. That's something I'm looking for. I'm looking for that sort of nervy, butterfly-y kind of feeling. And then all those other factors, they do come into play now. I mean, I have two kids and they're little and I have to think about that. You know, my husband also has a big job and it depends on what he's doing at the time and where are we and can one of us be home, you know, is really kind of the idea that we are trying to manage. It doesn't always happen, but all of those factors come into play. But if there's something that I cannot say no to because this character is so unbelievably complex and oh my gosh, I'm so excited about it. Like, we'll make it work, you know? And that kind of goes both ways. Mm-hmm. I think also if it was a right director that I, you know, haven't had the chance to work with, that would be a big factor too, or a particular actor or actress, you know, that would make a difference.
Yeah, of course. Of course. When it comes to shooting the more intense, I would say, I mean, the show's a bit gory. Are there moments that are a bit gory? What was that like for you? How did you kind of prepare to get into those more intense dark scenes?
Well, weirdly enough, I've been a part of a lot of gory stuff in my career.
I think back
I'm kind of desensitized to sticky fake blood and fake weapons and things like that. Not to say that this was, you know, I don't want to trivialize what happened here, because I think the key to what we were trying to do is not glorify this violence, but also present the violence the way that it was described in the court documents, and what we're saying behind the, you know, what we're saying with the show is this is one side of the story. This is not Betty's story. This is Candy's story. Betty is not here to tell her side. So we really don't know what actually happened. We know one side of it. And we needed to be respectful of that. So if we in terms of the gory parts, we followed very clearly what Candy said happened via the evidence documents, the court documents. So we didn't mean to make it gory. It just was. And in terms of preparing for that, it's a hard thing to prepare for. I think you just have to prepare psychologically for what the character is experiencing and this trigger moment that happens. And it's almost like a blackout. Like, she describes it as she wasn't even there. She was looking at herself doing this thing, like an out of body experience is sort of the way it read to me. So that gives me freedom as an artist to sort of go outside of my body, right? As we're doing these horrible, gory bits, and then kind of connect back to it at some point. And then really more than anything, be so present that you can see what you've done and react to that. So that's kind of the way I was looking at those sequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before I go, I need to ask about Cruel Summer, because I'm a huge fan, one of my favorite shows of last year. So obviously we know that changes are coming in season two. And I mean, when you guys did The Sinner, I assume you kind of went through the same kind of thing as to like, what now is where to go with these characters. But I'm curious how you feel about this new group coming in, this new story, because, and if there's any fear, because people really fell in love with those season one characters.
Yes. I mean, there's a ton of fear and risk, right? When you're taking a show that had a great first season where people loved it and really started to connect to these people, and then completely take them all away and bring a whole new cast of characters. It's a huge risk. Are we nervous? Yes. Were we nervous for The Sinner too? Yes. But thinking about The Sinner, we had a lot of discussion about, do we bring Cora back? Is there a way to keep this story going for multiple seasons? And it sort of feels similar to what happened with Cruel Summer as well, in terms of the story and in terms of what happened at the very last episode to both of those characters. Cora's going into a mental institution for 2 years. So when she comes out of that, what do we have? Is it a season just of her in a mental institute? Is it a season of her coming out of that, having lost her family, not probably her marriage probably does, you know, all this stuff. We're like, this is depressing. Like nobody, we thought as a creative team, like that is just not a strong entry for a female protagonist. Then what happens? Does she like start, is it a buddy buddy thing? Like, does she start helping solve? It was complicated. And it didn't seem like the best way to serve the show. It kind of broke all of our hearts a little bit. I was kind of even into it too. Like if we could find a way in, we would have done it. Same thing a little bit with Cruel Summer. At the end, when you really realize who Jeanette is and what she did, is that the way to start the next season? I mean, sure, we could have, but where do we take her from there? Does she then become a part of more controversy and more? It felt like it was going to be a little hard to believe. And we really, really tried to pride ourselves in grounding that show in a reality, in real base, reality base. So when crazy things start to happen, you believe it. And we're not asking you to, you know, sort of disband your belief, you know, to something that's outrageous. We want to really tell complicated stories for young people in this show and things that really change them profoundly and make them make decisions and watch them make bad decisions as we all did when we were little. So that's kind of the parallels to that. That's at least the way I felt about it. I'm not totally sure how Michelle feels or how the rest of our creative team specifically felt, but that was a big reason why we sort of shifted our focus to, okay, new story, new mystery, new cast, mm-hmm. new time period. That also gave us the opportunity to jump forward in time in a big way. I mean, we could have done that too, I guess, no matter what, but we just felt that that was the best way to serve the show and what we were trying to say and the stories we were trying to tell for that show.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any, are we in the same world as those season one characters? Like, is there a world that one of them could pop up in the future?
I mean, there's definitely a world, right? Where one could pop up for sure. Those characters still exist, you know, in some ulterior universe. It was hard. I mean, really, some of my most close confidants and mentors were saying, you cannot get rid of these characters. You cannot not have Jeanette and Kate. And I was like, I know, but what do we do with them? You know? So there's always a possibility.
Yeah. Just having coffee in the background somewhere.
Right. Right. Just having coffee. And then just somebody glances at them and goes, and then that's it. Right. Yes. I mean, dropping little Easter eggs and things like that. We do that a lot in this show. And we thought about a bunch of different ways to sort of have them somewhat in, but not really. But then we thought, well, how can we ask these amazing actors who were our leads in this first season to come and play a very small part in the next season? It just was not adding up, you know?
Yeah.
A cameo is one thing, but sort of like a CCD storyline might not make any sense for them either. Well, so a lot of moving parts, really.
Absolutely. Well, we like to wrap our awards podcast with some silly questions. The first is, maybe I've asked it, the question people ask you the most.
About this particular project?
Sure.
I think probably the most is, why did you want to do this? You know, what is it about the character and the story that was so interesting?
Yeah. All right. A TV show in history that you wish you were part of.
Oh my gosh, so many shows. My So-Called Life, Sopranos. Oh gosh. Say Yes to the Dress. I love that show.
So fun. What would people be surprised that you watch? Maybe a guilty pleasure. I guess you just said one, but.
I did kind of just out myself pretty badly. I don't think they have any more seasons, but like Lego Masters, I love watching with my son, like genuinely love watching that show. Say Yes to the Dress. I am a crazy, like weirdo history fan. So I watch all the strange World War II random discovery shows and, you know, all the things on ancient Egypt. I love watching to the dead, like, the demise of my husband is just like, dying of boredom on the couch, but
you're on the edge of your seat.
I love it. I love mummies.
What hobby would you be doing if you didn't have your day job? If you had more time?
What hobby?
Yeah.
What hobby? I love, love, love to read books, and I just for pleasure. I read a lot for work. I read books for work too. But honestly, I'm one of those people that could literally just sit alone and just fall into an imaginary world of a book. So I love doing that. But I could literally just be outside hiking, snowboarding, doing every sort of outdoor mountain activity you could think of and be very, very content doing that forever.
What is a good food that you can cook?
Oh, I make a killer oatmeal, which sounds so lame, but I think it's underrated oatmeal. Mm-hmm. I mean, my family eats it like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whenever it's the go-to. If someone's not feeling well, if I just can't get food in the baby, we go back to the oatmeal. I do that pretty well.
Always works. All right. Last but not least, besides your show, of course, what are you rooting for this Emmy season?
That's a good question. I loved The Dropout. I loved watching that. I thought she was just fantastic. I thought she was amazing. I'm watching and finishing Girl from Plainville. And also I love The Great. I think Elle's amazing. I've been watching Severance, which, I mean, I don't necessarily know what's going on in terms of like who's in the running for these things, but I'm just thinking of shows that are just recently out. All of them, right?
Yeah.
Also, I'm really excited for The Staircase. You've seen it? Oh, you have a good job.
Can't wait enough.
I'm so excited because that was Antonio who did Sinner first season, like 1, 2, 3. I'm a huge fan of his. I was a huge fan of that documentary. What an intriguing story. What a great cast. I'm really excited for The Staircase.
Jessica, thank you so much and congratulations. Candy is so, so great. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Candy Star and executive producer Jessica Biel. The show is now streaming on Hulu. And after the break, Winning Time star Adrian Brody. From Los Angeles, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. It's the Variety Awards Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. We just talked to Jessica Biel about playing a real-life individual in a fictionalized project, and now we've got another. HBO's Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, stars John C. Reilly as Dr. Jerry Buss, who has a dream of adding some flash to the NBA by buying the Lakers, recruiting rookie sensation Magic Johnson, played by Quincy Isaiah, and turning it into the hottest ticket in Los Angeles. Well, spoiler alert, he did succeed, but there are plenty of bumps along the way, and that included the journey before winding up with the right coach. We know that would eventually be Pat Riley, but in season one of Winning Time, Pat, played by Adrian Brody, is still an assistant coach under temporary coach Paul Westhead, and even that role is threatened as Buss's original coach, the injured Jack McKinney, is nursed back to health.
Pal, can you turn this up a minute?
To get eyes on him now, we might see him later on in the season.
You've been holding it together for a while now, but it must be nice to have McKinney travel with the team again.
Yeah, well, Jack's still got a road ahead.
You don't expect him back for playoffs?
You shanty Irish New York cocksucker, fuck you.
You first. I don't speak for Jack or anybody else, but, the way the team's playing under Paul, we got a good thing. Everybody's happy. Changing horses midstream, that's just a big risk.
When Pat Riley first enters Winning Time, he hasn't yet turned into the coach with the Armani suits and slick back hair. In 1979, he's trying out to do color commentary with Lakers announcer Chick Hearn, but ultimately he realizes his true calling. But we're not there yet, which means we'll likely see more of Pat Riley's evolution in Season 2. I recently spoke with Brody about the unique gig of playing a fictional version of Pat Riley. Given the pacing of the show, I asked him what he knew about how the story would unfold.
It's always a work in progress. It was being written and evolving as I signed on. But I knew that there would be this slow progression, kind of Pat Riley earning his stripes. And, it was fascinating to learn about that, because I think one thing that I realized I kind of took for granted, and I think it's what the show does so well, is it shows how everybody has to overcome all these trials and tribulations and to get to that place. And I just feel like I think we're in for... seems to be people are responding to the show, and I think we're in for a nice run, which would be wonderful. And I think it'll take that just historically for Pat to get to the Pat Riley that we all know and love. And so I feel like, I was aware of it. It was something that I knew was coming. I just didn't know what a transformation it was for him personally. Yeah. And that came after doing the research, but I definitely knew that this would be, and it's a wonderful arc. I think it's a really wonderful arc. And it's given me even greater appreciation for the man.
Yeah. It's an interesting arc, and you start out a little bit as comic relief. I mean, watching Pat Riley try to be play by play and having Chick Hearn, who is a little more, out there than, we remember him.
I mean, I think they were pals. I mean, Chick was a big reason, but it was very helpful to Patrick. So I feel like that is, it's a fun dynamic within the storytelling for sure. But, it wasn't his calling, clearly. And I've done quite a bit of research, and I've seen Pat talk, and Pat is actually quite well-spoken and eloquent, even when he's depicting those things. So there is a bit of comic relief in the storytelling, but what they're capturing is the struggle for him. And he was, in addition to this kind of color man announcer, at that period, he was also like a travel coordinator and working these kind of low level positions. And, it's amazing. He had a lot to offer, and it's amazing. He had the tenacity and the access ultimately to finally, for all of these life events to transpire, for him to be in that position to become assistant coach at that time and ultimately coach. It's an amazing story.
Yeah. Kind of right time, right place, obviously. By the way, have you ever tried your hand at, sports play by play? Was that anything that ever interested you? Do you watch a lot?
Announcing for me? My brain doesn't work in quite as linear a fashion. I mean, I feel like I see a lot. My mother's a photographer, and I feel like a lot of what she possesses, which I believe is an innate ability, not something that is just something that she's cultivated, is very similar to how I am as an actor. And I connect to things and see things in an emotional way and absorb details in a very emotional memory. And so it's difficult for me to analytically dissect something right directly, because I have several other things going on for me that I'm processing and absorbing, and that's the way that it works for me. So I don't think I'd be the right candidate to do that. I'm sure it's something I could work towards, but it takes me time to process things and find my way, rather than have to, spell it out for everybody in an audio.
Well, I know you, so you grew up obviously on the East Coast. I know you've said that you were a Knicks fan growing up, but obviously you grew up, I think we're around the same age. You grew up in the era of Showtime Lakers. So you were very aware of what was going on with the team. What do you kind of remember from the time and what you remember growing up of Magic and Kareem and just that whole squad?
I've always liked the Lakers a lot. And you know, I've spent a lot of my years kicking around in LA as an actor, as a young man, you know, there. And so I've watched a lot of games and, you know, they're amazing. They're some of the greatest players ever. Kareem and Magic changed, you know, the way we basketball as we know it, like that whole Showtime era kicked in with them and this time period that's being depicted by the show, obviously, but that fast break basketball. And so that, I mean, I was pretty young still. So I feel like, you know, I remember Pat Riley from those days.
Yeah.
And what he just left a real indelible impression on me. And it's a funny thing because I couldn't tell you many other coaches from that time. And you know what I mean? It's like, so it's rare for a coach to leave that impression. Of course, you watch what everyone's doing and you see how they handle certain things. But I guess he really cut a very sharp image of what a coach would be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was as big a star at one point as his players. It's, you know, this imposing figure on the sidelines wearing those suits and of course, mm-hmm. slick back hair. It was like kind of just the combination of things and the fact that he was in LA and easily accessible to sort of turn into a celebrity in his own right. So, and what's exciting about your show is that we haven't seen that yet. So there's a lot still to come. And that's kind of, it's always interesting when you do a show that's sort of, you know, adapted from real life, that's sort of a take on some beats that we know, like we're kind of expecting certain things. They've been teasing all season the moment that Pat starts slicking his hair back. We haven't gotten there yet, but he's been looking in the mirror a couple of times. And then these interesting moments where they've even done a quick flash of an older Pat Riley looking in the mirror. So they're definitely having some fun teasing something that we're all waiting for and all expecting. So that's got to be kind of interesting when you're working on a project like this, where people sort of know certain things are going to happen and they're expecting it and they're curious, how is the show going to do this?
Yeah. I mean, I have that same anticipation myself. And you know, it's exciting. It's knowing the success that he has achieved and the personal growth and everything. I always look at it as a bit like, you know, it's like really having faith because you have to believe that it's doable. And he's not in a position, you know, he's going through this phase that things aren't always working in his favor, and they're starting to, but it's a lot of work to get there. And it's kind of a reminder to have faith. You need to believe that something is achievable to achieve that. You can't expect to achieve those things. And I think it's a really interesting thing in the reading that I've done of Pat's own writings and his books. He conveys such a need for preparedness for the inevitable obstacles that come. Beyond being an athlete and beyond teamwork and working collectively in that sense, that's all a priority. But your own personal preparation for, you know, whatever it is, your own demons, the obstacles that come up on a day-to-day basis and how to meet those challenges. And it's a really inspiring character to play, you know, but I guess I digress, but what I'm trying to get at is because I know and we know what's to come, it's kind of fun to dig in deep to the moments where it's not really flowing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about the journey. Now, speaking of preparation, you know, obviously the question when you're playing a living figure is how much did you want to reach out, or did you decide you didn't want to reach out to the actual Pat Riley? What was sort of your thinking and how you wanted to research the man, you know, actually in person versus not?
I mean, it's important to honor the person you're playing and to do the work and the research and you know, uphold the image and the personality and the characteristics of that individual. You know, I've had to do this in many occasions and in many roles, and you know, and it's a responsibility, and you also have a responsibility to honor the script and the work that's being written. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I found his writings and his books to be really a wonderful divining rod for me. And whether that's on the page or not, that's always kind of helped me tap into truths. And you know, I didn't want to make this an impression of him in the least. And, you know, it isn't a biopic. It's a story that is based on, you know, this time in history when, you know, basketball became basketball as we know it, and a very exciting time in the 80s. And I think it delves into areas of all of the characters' lives. And you know, I think there's, you know, an opportunity to embrace that time, really.
Have you heard at all from Pat or from his camp or from people at all on I know some folks have been a little more vocal than others, real life folks, which
yeah,
we know what we're talking about, but I haven't seen any reaction from Pat at all. He's been quiet.
I haven't spoken to Pat directly about it. We have a lot of friends in common and associates in common, and you know, he knows that I'm a big fan, and that definitely knows my enthusiasm for this, and that I've been doing a ton of research. And so, but we, you know, yeah, we haven't been in touch.
Yeah. Well, I do feel like you're doing him justice. So I do hope that he sees that. And I think it's one of the more interesting growth stories of the season so far, and seeing Pat from point A to point B already as we head to season one finale. Been a busy year for you. It's always a busy year. You're also in contention this year for your scene stealing moments on Succession. That must have been fun to kind of go and play with those folks for a bit and join that show, which also is quite a phenomenon, and play a billionaire at a time where we're nothing but talking about billionaires in the media. So
it preceded that, unfortunately.
Well, there's always been billionaires in the media.
Yeah, that's even true. There's always billionaires in the media.
There's even more so now. But okay, kind of give me the quick synopsis on how that role all came about and your experience.
Well, I tell you, it's been such a privilege to get to come and play on Succession. I'm a huge fan of the show and all the great work that's being done there. And Adam McKay, obviously, is a creatively involved in both of these shows. So as Max and I were all in discussions with me coming on to play Riley, and I'm doing my research to try and understand the man, and they had proposed this opportunity to play Josh Aronson on Succession. And I thought, it's funny, when it rains, it pours. It's like, you know, you say it's always a busy year, but it's not always a busy year. And I'm really grateful to have had so many really interesting dramatic roles and so vastly different to delve into. And, you know, that was just a real gift because, you know, like I said, I'm a huge fan, and the acting is superb on the show. The writing is superb. And they crafted that role for me. I had some thoughts and they embellished it based on those. And, you know, the man that I play in that is an amalgamation of several people that I do know and a fictional character, obviously, that they've created, but it tonally, you know, I feel like I knew how I wanted to pick that guy. And it just was really, it's really fun. I mean, it's kind of fun to play someone with that level of power, especially in a, you know, with swimming with sharks that were, you know, really infallible. Yeah, and through all their infighting, they still reigned supreme. And then for him to kind of come in there and be able to, and in a short moment, disrupt that. And I think it's really fun for me, but I think it's fun for the audience too, because they're used to seeing their family in a pretty omnipotent setting.
Yeah. Yeah. And to see someone who has so much FU money that he's not intimidated by them, and he can just, show up and just like throw a wrench into whatever they were up to. was a lot of fun. Yeah, speaking of busy year, I mean, you've got 4 releases coming out this fall, which is...
Do I? That's good.
You've got Blonde.
I'm just buckling down, really? Okay, tell me.
You've got Blonde on Netflix. You've got the Searchlight feature, See How They Run, with Sam Rockwell, Saoirse Ronan, David Oyelowo. I cannot pronounce it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Asteroid City, your latest Wes Anderson collab. So that sounds like fun.
These are all coming out this fall.
Apparently. Manodrome, opposite Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough. Yeah, and then you're currently filming Ghosted opposite Chris Evans and Ana de Armas. So from Dexter.
I just wrapped my bit on Ghosted, but I am in the midst of shooting something which is wonderful, which is Poker Face with Rian Johnson, which is Ryan's new show that he's doing with Natasha Lyonne. That's really fun.
Well, that's cool. What do you what are you playing in that?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say anything. I'm really just jumping in. So I gotta watch it because I tend to spill the beans. But it's fun. It's a kind of murder mystery. It's a mystery, not a murder mystery. Excuse me. It's a mystery kind of detective like story that's really fun. It's really it's so well written. So yeah, it's all been very exciting.
That's great. Especially coming out of the pandemic, it sounds like it's been a good.
It's kicked everybody into gear. I mean, prior to that, I was very aware of time, and I think it's shared that preciousness and the precariousness of life. That understanding, I think a lot of people have kicked into gear. I mean, obviously, there's a need for content, you know, I'm hoping that the theatrical film world will pick up and continue to prosper because I do think that is, you know, it's such an important part of the work, and to share that communal feeling in a theater. And, you know, I just think that would be such a shame for dissipate because our habits have changed. And obviously the nature of the business has changed a lot, but, you know, it's a wonderful thing that there is great work and great material out there for not only for creative people in my profession, but for audiences to watch. And so that is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's more optimism now, I think, that it is coming back. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I've got the quick rapid fire 6 final questions for you. So here we go. What is the question people ask you the most? Maybe it's something I already asked you.
Are you... That's the question. They don't finish it. They expect me to. I had a woman ask me for my photo yesterday, and she said, "I don't know your name, but can I have a photo?" I said, "I'm Adrian, by the way."
That's hysterical.
Are you is the question I get a lot lately. Yeah.
Hey, they want you to say your name.
I don't know what they expect. I am. I assume I am.
That's funny. What TV show in history do you wish most you were a part of?
What TV show in history?
Yeah.
Any TV show. Oh, wow. That's great. Boy, it's a tough one for me to just spin it for you. There's a lot of shows.
A lot of classics.
What
was your favorite show growing up?
Columbo.
There you go. We're going to say Columbo.
All right.
Columbo was a great show. What hobby would you be doing if you didn't have your day job? What would you like to have more time to spend?
Souping up muscle cars, which is what I tried to do when I do have a minute time, but yeah.
That's cool. What's the one food you feel like?
And I paint, which is not quite, sorry, but I do paint, but the hobby is the muscle cars.
Muscle cars. That's very cool. What food do you think you probably can cook the best? What do you have a dish? Do you have a specialty when you're in the kitchen?
I do amazing pastas, so I can hook up a great sauce from scratch.
Okay.
A nice gravy.
And finally, besides your shows, anything you're rooting for this Emmy season? Anything you've watched over the past year that you're like, this show needs attention?
What have I seen that I've been loving? I've been really buckling down, so I haven't been watching much right now. Even I'm a little behind. I So I wish I could.
That's fine. I just listed like seven things you've been working on over the past couple of years. So I know you have not.
I really am. But I would like to have a little. Yeah, it's. Yeah.
That DVR.
Like to catch up, believe me.
That's Adrian Brody, star of Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, now streaming on HBO Max. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode, and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Emmy predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Emily Longaretta, and Clayton Davis, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit.